They're clowned as a conduit by which Larcher is produced. Because everything went fucking skewered sideways in my mid-30s when I found out I was adopted. What it did primarily was it anchored in reality my existential angst. As much as I loved language, I distrusted it because I knew or felt that it wasn't as truthful as things that could be conveyed in silence. The good thing about my character is it doesn't like its audience, plus it doesn't need its audience. Laughter is produced by creating tension and then giving it a gateway for it to escape. My personal narrative suddenly took a huge sideways shift. What are you going to do? And the answer was, get nasty.
Welcome to Stories from the Pitch, a podcast dedicated to the world of street performing and some of the crazy characters who populate this world. In this episode, Robert Nelson interviews performer and author Martin Ewan and discusses a career from its beginnings as a bank robbing clown to being a stilt dancing oddity in Tokyo to the discovery of his lurk persona in Paris and the realization that you don't need to be nice to an audience to fascinate them. If you have any suggestions about other performers you'd like to hear from or memories you'd like to share, please post them to the comment section of this podcast at buskerhalloffame.com. And now, here's Robert.
Matters not the job you've got.
The greatest icons of the street performing world.
As long as you do it well.
Never been so excited in my whole life.
Things that are made by plants well laid, the test of time will tell.
I knew I was going to get a little flack from each one of you.
You cannot count or know the amount.
I can do anything.
Or the value of a man by the show displayed or the beauty made by the touch of the juggler's hand.
Because no one really cares about me.
I am the Butterfly Man, and I thank you for your kind attention.
Welcome all you buskers, busker friends of buskers, and fans. Looking out, green surrounding us. My dog's lying underneath the trucks. Got my 1961 Morris Minor pickup truck that Martin Ewan had driven over for the couple of days, hanging out with me here. And we're talking about things we want to do together. Martin and I go way back. At least one of the most memorable moments I have ever had meeting a street performer after a show where a dog bit me right on the ass during the show while I was juggling fire. Big black Labrador came running up. I guess, I don't know, it was next to its master just sitting there. And then all of a sudden, it just jumps up, runs out while I was juggling the fire, bites me on the ass, and then runs right back and lies down next to his master again. I ended the show immediately after that. Didn't do the unicycle or anything because, you know, how are you going to follow a dog biting you on the ass? So I'm walking back, with pulling my little case down to the hotel about a block and a half away, and all of a sudden there's this guy next to me carrying stilts on his shoulder, kind of a strange-looking dude, walking, pacing right next to me. Obviously a performer himself, I didn't know who he was. And in his New Zealand twang, he turns to me and he goes, "I saw your show." And I said, "Did you see the dog bite me?" And he goes, yeah. "You're lucky it wasn't a brown dog, because I hear they're poisonous." And an instant friendship was born because I never heard anything so bizarre in my entire life. And of course, since then, I've gotten to know Martin over the years, primarily through his writing. Initially, he has a new book out called Panto Damascus, which you can download from Amazon or Lulu. And I think it's a great compilation of street busker stories. I certainly have read it, and I've recommended it to a lot of friends. So without further ado, let's get into meeting Mr. Martin Ewan. I'd like to find out a little bit about your background.
I was born in Christchurch, New Zealand.
Oh, you were born in Christchurch itself?
No, actually, I don't know, because everything went fucking skewered sideways in my mid-30s when I found out I was adopted. So my personal narrative suddenly took a huge sideways shift at that point. and what I thought about my origins and where I'd come from
right.
and everything.
Right.
The foundation just shifted slightly about 5 points something on the Richter scale and then settled again. And
so
I'm like,
they never told you.
No, I found out from a drunken cousin in a guard bar.
You're already a performer now.
I started when I was 20 going on 21 performing. Although I had performed at school and I had done some other little things in my teens, sort of surreptitious stuff with a friend as clowns. We robbed a bank. We attempted to rob a bank, which is funny, but that's another story. The bottom line is, no, I've been performing for quite some time, such that it could have even been the same Wellington Festival I made the dog comment. And, yeah, that was a bit of a shock.
Did it change you in any way? I mean, did it...
What it did primarily was it anchored in reality my existential angst, which I thought prior to that was just something I was afflicted with.
Well, you talked about your roots as a bank robber and a clown.
Me and a friend with little plastic pistols were working on a street. I was doing unicycle, he was doing juggling, and there was a bank on the street that was cordoned off to pedestrians, and so we went in and he wrote, "Give me all your money" on a teller's form, and waited as incongruously as a full-faced clown can wait in the queue while I stood furtively at the door. And these pistols were like stylized, they're about 2 inches, they're little bubble things. And I stood at the door keeping a lookout, and when it came to his turn, he gave the teller the thing with, "Give me all your money," and then he ducked. She looked at it, freaked out, looked up. He wasn't there. So she started going forward to see whether, in fact, he was underneath the counter. And so he was coming up with the water pistol cocked. She was coming forward, and they met. He shot her in the face. She screamed. He ran out of the bank. I ran out of the bank. Nothing else ever happened about that particular deal. This is in the old days, and it was just no one, you know, everyone would just... There was no protocols in place.
So you started out robbing a bank and getting
one of the first things we did.
You didn't get any money, but...
We started off being clowns, being whiteface. I had a couple of little turns that we'd do. We had a granny bike. I'd ride on the handlebars, he'd bike around. We would do guerrilla theatre outside schools.
You weren't busking, though.
No, there was no money in it.
All right.
Were just doing it for the effect. I remember one day we were coming home, and there's a couple of fire engines in the distance and a big crowd, and we're like, "Oh, the audience ready-made." And so we're turning up, and it was our house that was on fire. And then there's this audience watching the flames and the fire being put off, and these two white-faced clowns on a granny bike skid to a halt and stare at it and go, "That's our house," which just provided that level of entertainment for the onlookers that they had lacked up to then. I turned into a positive, because it was like 2 weeks before Christmas, and I let everybody in my family know that I'm really sorry, but and my house burnt down and all my Christmas presents were destroyed. So that was the only year I had a really good excuse for not giving anyone any.
But why a clown? Where'd that come from?
Primarily, it came from early reading of a lot of literature and working out that words were really good and powerful, because primarily I wanted to be a mime, and clowns used mime a lot. And as much as I loved language, I distrusted it, because I knew or felt that it wasn't as truthful as things that could be conveyed in silence. You know, that early intellectual teen idealism that gives you some of your best revelations, I suppose, because you can grasp onto things and you believe them so wholeheartedly. I could see it being the only thing I could do in life where I wouldn't need to compromise myself.
And you still consider yourself a clown now, don't you?
You can boil it down to it being a means to an end, though. I mean, a clown is a conduit by which laughter is produced. If you want to get away from the clown being a noun, you know, a clown
right.
is a verb. A clown is a conduit by which laughter is produced.
Hmm, that's very interesting. In fact, it's a revelation. From a white-faced granny bike clown, despite watching your house burn down or robbing a bank, it's still nothing like Lurk. You're 10 feet in the air. You must have had some reason to go up there. I mean, I never saw a clown before that just worked with a fly swatter. And the only prop being a fly swatter in a mirror?
Yeah, mirror.
I remember that.
Piecemeal. Things just happened piecemeal. The only reason that I started stilts was I went to clown school when I was 20. And
where was that?
That was in Auckland. A couple of years just immediately after clown school. My teacher, Alan Clay, was very good for me in that primarily what he did was give me permission to do the things that I wanted to do. He would frame questions. He'd say, what are you thinking about? Because we'd have a show that we had to have new material for on the Friday, and on the Tuesday I'd say, I've got nothing. And he'd go, what have you been thinking about? And I'd say, isolation and how everybody is locked inside their own consciousness, and it's only ritual that allows us to share anything at all. And he'd smile and go, that's good. Do a show about that then. And so come Friday, my clown, who at that point was called Vernon Vortex.
Love the name.
And his whole premise was, and the way he used to introduce himself, was that vortexes are kind of absences and stuff in that, and it's my job to go around filling them up. And so come that Friday, I turn up with a modified shoe storage unit and sell it as an isolation chamber and talk about isolation and then demonstrate isolating myself. And it sounds bizarre, and it was bizarre, but it was very funny, as evidenced by the laughter it produced. And what happened was, this is all to do with how I got onto stilts. I did a number of these very strange things for about 2 years. Vernon Vortex also went on between punk rock bands on stage with a Bible and talked about his relationship with God and read bits out of Deuteronomy and then described how he had killed God in an argument. And that got a big cheer. And
where?
That was in Auckland.
My God.
And what happened was, after 2 years of this just turbocharged eccentricity where nothing had failed, I just was not challenged by it. I pulled clown out of the bag because I thought it was probably the hardest thing to be successful at, after having been told my entire life that I was some sort of overly intelligent thing that could be anything he wanted and was wasting his life. This was from like the age of 6 on. I found clown really too easy, and I grew bored with it and depressed and retired at 22. And spent 9 months on unemployment being morose. Meanwhile, my friend Rob McLaren had joined a stilt, a very serious archetypical stilt dance group, and one of its members was leaving. And so he suggested that because of the balance, I'd done a lot of balance work and acrobatic stuff, that I'd be brought in as a member. And so I was asked to, and then for a further 2 years, I left my clown behind, sort of, and did these stilt dance pieces. However, I would use the entire cast as the warm-up act and write material, and when we did a national tour, we'd start with Anti-Gravity Theatre, and I'd do the first half an hour, and that's where...
It's your website now, Anti-Gravity.
No. Once I got to America, I sort of shelved the Anti-Gravity thing because of the New York-based acrobatic group. And I just use my name now. Because I liked Anti Gravity. It was a brilliant idea. It was like,
but was that your concept? It was their concept. Was it Stalker's concept?
No, it was my concept. And they contacted me because I was using Anti Gravity as a business thing out of Australia, and I do predate them in the use of that name, but it doesn't matter, and I'm not that attached to it. I was attached to it at the time because it's the definition is of levity and of and you know how comedy is against mortality. It's like laughing in the face of mortality. All this Anti Gravity had so many resonances that probably only I got off on. But so yeah. Back to the linear thing, that's how I started on stilts. My clown had always been trying successfully to digest reality in on his own terms, and trying with mixed success to get the world to accept that. And I did the stilts for 2 years, wrote some new material.
What year was that? Because I remember the Stalkers in Darling Harbour.
Probably 80. Yeah, but that's the second. That was the second generation of Stalker.
Oh, you weren't in that one.
No.
Oh, okay. But they had a big name.
Yeah, I mean, the name had been building for a while. But then what happened was they were a New Zealand group, and then
right. What
happened for about three generations was that the director David Clarkson would get a group together and just burn them to death, just leave them a smouldering heap of frustration and physical exhaustion, and then he'd step sideways, grab a new crew, and do it again.
Yeah, but you learned a lot of this technique that you have on stilts.
All my stilt stuff is from Stalker.
Yeah, so, I mean, it gave you a tremendous...
I'm not ungrateful.
No, I mean, you can use that when you can't use other things, too, and I've seen you do that, you know, when they want... like 2 minutes of
visual
fluff. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I wouldn't call it fluff because it's really good stuff. I mean,
I've got a virtuoso stilt technique built on the fact that not many people put 25 years into such a singular specialty.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I look really natural on stilts because no one else has been on them almost full time for 25 years.
It didn't pick off like juggling.
Who wasn't plastering a ceiling somewhere.
Right. You know? Okay. Well, I mean, you don't use the same kind of stilts.
No.
But, I mean.
So, yeah, that's where I got the stilts. And then we folded as a group after 2 years. We all got burnt out. And so, again, I started a now familiar pattern of being self-indulgent and morose and despairing and did nothing. Meanwhile, Rob McLaren, who'd got me into the Stilt group,
You went to Japan.
Did a commercial for extra leg room for some car, and which got him the money to get to Japan.
Oh,
and then
okay.
He went to Japan and
now this was the early days of in Tokyo, if I'm not mistaken.
Early,
yeah.
This
so
was
no,
like
there wasn't a big busking thing.
There was none.
Yeah.
None.
And so you guys created that?
He was, I would say, because he predates me there by about 6 months to 9 months.
Yeah.
He would have been one of the first three street performers in Tokyo.
So that would seem to me a very tough thing to break into. And basically because the Japanese, even when I went over there much later than you guys, I didn't go over until 1989.
Well, no, we only predated you by about a year. We were like 80, 88.
But there was more people had gone before
it,
me.
It blew up really fast.
Yeah.
And because
what I was trying to get to is the fact that they didn't tip as normal Americans would. After a meal, you put a tip down, you tip the car part, you. But there was no tipping there, and I had a very difficult time with that when I was there. I wasn't required to pass the hat because I was being paid to be there, but Apparently the manager or the actual owner of these expositions had seen me and said to Yoshiko Artland, is Robert Nelson not a street performer? And she goes, yes, he is. And does a street performer not pass the hat at the end? And she says, well, yes, they do, normally. He says, well, why is Robert Nelson not passing the hat? Well, obviously, the next day, I was required by the people that hired me to pass the hat. And yet, I got almost nothing. I went chip, whoa, kudasai.
It was so easy. Once you knew how to do it.
Well, yeah, but the Flying Dutchman, thank goodness, happened to call me that night or that evening, and they were working in Holland Village, and I was talking to McKeel, and I said, McKeel, you know, do you guys pass the hat over there, and by any chance? And he goes, oh yeah, yeah, you know, we're killing, we're making all kinds of money, you know. And I said, well, I think I got 50 yen today, maybe total of 500 yen, $4 for a good sized crowd and everything, and I just, nobody put anything in. And he said, well, just say this, Robert. And my Japanese, I've tried to study it. I've always found it a difficult language to learn. But back then, all I could learn was the phonetic. And I bet I could still do it down. Watashi wa daido genyen no pro desu. Watashi wa nagaisen de sei ketsu tsutei imasu. Kore ga mihon desu. Which essentially means, I'm a professional street performer. If you like my show, do like I do. And then I would pull out a 1,000 yen note, which was at the time $8. It was $8 back then, and the exchange rate, and which was a significant amount of money. It's like saying put a 5 in, you know, like we all do. And it got a laugh. And that laugh turned into hundreds and hundreds of extra dollars for me every day, because we were required to do 3 shows. And I was never ungrateful to the Dutchman for giving me that. And thank God they did. They made me look. I mean, when you pass the hat at the end of the show and you don't get anything,
it reflects badly.
Yeah, everything. It does. Not to say I've always gotten a good hat, but anyway, so you're over in Tokyo in the early days.
How I did
breaking it all in, I guess.
Yeah, how I did it was I worked that out as well. And
where was that exactly? I mean, I'd never performed.
I'd work in. I'd do 3 a day.
Where the place?
I'd go to Shinjuku, then catch a train to Harajuku, do a couple of shows there, then go to Shibuya and do a couple of shows there. So spread
it's
them out over
spots.
3 different places,
different spots.
And I didn't speak at all, so.
You didn't have to, though.
No, but in terms of my making money off the street, it was, I worked out that because of the whole Asian Confucius harmony being everything, group dynamic thing, like laughter is produced by creating tension and then giving it a gateway for it to escape. Mm-hmm. Making money was the same thing. You created a vacuum of purpose and then gave it an outlet. I had a remote-controlled hat. At the end of my show, I had a hat that was on a disguised tip truck. And I would just push a button and send it out into the middle of the crowd. No, at the edge of the middle of my stage. Then, initially, I'd have a plant come in. Bang.
You plant it.
Put the 1,000 yen in.
Show them what
monkey
to do.
See, monkey do. Right. Oh my God, he's given us the answer.
Yes.
That's what we want. More than the money itself, we just need to know what to do.
Right.
Then everyone puts it in, and then you pull. And I boiled it down to a 3.5 minute show.
in this 3.5 minute show, was that Lurk, or the beginnings of Lurk, or it was it disgruntled?
It was a straight-out dance piece. Start with Mozart. Start with Mozart. Go into light pop. Go back. Go to Iggy Pop. Go back to Mozart and finish with Fred Astaire.
And nice.
My character was buffeted by the different dance styles. The music would change. My character would be like, and appear to like improvise really good different dance styles.
But this doesn't generate laughter generally.
Yeah.
Amusement perhaps, but I doubt if he got punched laughs from it, unless you had some.
No, I was wowing them with my movement technique more than anything else.
You were what?
Wowing them with my movement technique.
Right. So obviously you had to get to a point where this dancing was not, I mean, in your own words, you said fluff. But I'm not going to say that because I like the dynamic of the dance. But what we're talking about here is in Tokyo, as a busker, legitimate busker for the first time, you are on stilts doing a dance piece with maybe some comic.
It's a comic dance
piece. It's a comic dance piece, but it's not a necessarily a lap. A punch, laugh, left, generating.
But then,
was it a circle show? Was it? Did you work?
It was a circle show.
Yeah, okay.
Although it was a half circle show, you know, I wouldn't get people behind me.
Yeah.
But then what transpired was all the commercial work that you got in Japan was you were paid for 3 20-minute shows a day.
Right.
I would make about 30% less doing those than I could on the street. Because I could really make good money on the street with a 3.5-minute show that made me $100 every 3.5 minutes. Mm-hmm. But I got to travel that way, and it was nice. I had a roadie, and I was flown places and stayed in a hotel and got to watch pixelated porn.
All over Japan.
All over Japan.
So you did get to travel around?
In this 20-minute bracket that I was given, I could develop a character because I only had a 3.5-minute show.
Okay.
So that was all my interactive stuff, which was the beginnings of Lurk at that point.
Okay. So Lurk was born in Japan.
In as much as he was gestated.
Is there not a disgruntled, maybe inwardly they're disgruntled people, but outwardly they seem to be very, very good audience. I mean, I always found them to be a very good audience. They love slapstick. They love visual humor.
They're a good audience. Whatever the opposite of spoilt was, like culturally, New Zealand audiences and Australian audiences in the 80s were not attuned to street theatre anyway. And so the first 5 minutes of any show, you were marinating in this group sort of thought that was your audience going, not what is he doing, but why is he doing it?
My God, I thought they just didn't like me.
Yeah, no, they're like that.
I was there.
You get that, and you got to stop taking it personally because it's really easy to take it personally. You've got all these stony-faced people just staring
at you. Yeah, nothing. They're like, you hear a wind blow.
They're not thinking, like, what is he doing? Because it's self-evident what you're doing. You're performing.
Right.
They're asking themselves because they're
coaching. Why is he doing this?
Why is he doing this? Whereas in Europe, that question is automatically culturally answered.
Absolutely. So big change.
Same in Japan because it was new. They're going, why is he doing it? Mm. But all you have to do is have a strong form in Japan because they're form junkies. You give them, they need form.
Oh, I see. Tell them what they're supposed to do.
Show them what's going on. Show them where the borders are. Show them what the expectations are. Because the most anxiety you could ever culturally give groups of Japanese people is tell them all to do their own thing, you know?
Right.
Collectively, they just wanted the anxiety to go away.
Right. You know? I married one of those.
Yeah. So
she loved the anxiety to go away.
Just, you know, and ritual quantifies chaos, which so it's like as long as there's a... Apparently it came from the 16th century when there was a coup attempt in Japan and the samurai got sort of 007 license to kill. And were spread out everywhere, and
the Tokugawa era.
The rule was if anyone does anything, in inverted commas, out of the ordinary, it was an It was a death sentence. And that went right down to how you pass the salt. You know, so apparently Japanese were a lot more Mediterranean before that happened. But centuries of that stultifying something made them rigid, more rigid. Apparently they were gay.
So this Tokyo thing, I mean the Japan thing, that lasted
it lasted for about 3.5 years.
Wow.
I popped off to Sydney for 6 months once. I made in my this was like 24 to 27. I made all the money I wanted, had all the fun I wanted. And then I did a long season where I did Nagasaki Circus, and I did, basically I worked for 21 days straight, and I decided that it was time to leave because I hadn't been to Europe before, and my great fear watching other performers in Japan was that sooner or later they were eaten and digested by the cheese monster, because Japanese audiences love cheesy stuff.
Right.
Because it's easy, it's formulaic.
Yep. Yep.
And I was watching people, and I had my own prejudices against American culture as it was, coming from New Zealand. And I was just, I knew that to stay in Japan and to be successful continuously, I wouldn't have the energy not to become cheesy.
Right.
And I hadn't been to Europe before, and I knew that in my heart, that's where I belonged.
Right.
And so, yeah, wow. After 3 years, I had a certain amount of money saved up, more money than I'd ever had before. And I went to Thailand I left Japan, I went to Thailand, I spent a month and a half because I needed to get something out of my system, and that was, how long does it take me to be bored when I have everything I need? So I went to, I consciously did it. I went to a beach place.
You do that, don't you?
I went to a beach place. I had heaps of, I could have stayed there for years. I had a beach place.
But you got bored.
I had all the stimulation chemically that I needed. I had, there wasn't any relationship happening stuff there because that shit terrifies me. But I was swimming. I was renting the only motorbike on the island. And after a month, I'm like, okay, I can see the end now. This is, I'm starting to feel unsettled and that there is more.
So off we go from Thailand too.
So, no, then I went to Bangkok and got another 2.5 weeks.
There you go.
And then
there
I came back just in case, you know, because I needed to hit this nail on the head.
Okay, okay.
So that for the rest of my life, it wasn't ever going to be, I just need to escape, because I'd already escaped. And I knew that wasn't the answer. The answer wasn't sitting on a beach doing nothing. And so at that point, I left. I went to Paris first, and I worked in two places in Paris, one in the daytime, one at night.
Where were they?
Pompidou during the daytime,
right.
And Boo Boo during the Latin Quarter during the nighttime. And I was still doing the dance piece at that point. But there was a lot of other interactive stuff that would happen beforehand, and I would just do that.
You mentioned a guy who was an influence on you one time in the past to me, somebody that I was familiar with from San Francisco in the early 80s, and that was a guy named Gustav.
And you timed this brilliant, because it was in Paris that I met Gustav.
So he changed. I mean, I don't see... I honestly don't see the similarities.
No.
But you tell me the story. How did that...
Well, like my teacher, Alan Clay, what Gustav did was validated the things I wanted to do. I saw him, and he was an unhappy clown.
Right.
And I looked at him.
You were just an unhappy clown, but not performing it yet.
I wasn't quite as vindictive as I saw
him.
So
this is the beginnings of Lurk.
Yeah,
then.
Definitely.
Okay. So it's after Japan, then. And you see this guy, Gustav.
He was gestating in Japan in that night.
What did he do that made you say, that's it for me?
He did not like his audience.
And he said, that's it.
Yeah.
I get it now. That's what I want to do with the rest. I don't like you people here. Yeah.
He was just...
Well, I'm sorry. But
he would just look at his audience with just disdain and disgust.
Yeah. Yeah, he didn't do that.
And then he'd pull out a little paintbrush from his overalls. And this is also where I'm not sure this is where I recognize it, but it's an example of it. When I know that certain members of the audience, when they watch me, get to a point where they get just about everything I do. But it takes a while.
Yes,
for them to get.
But that's engaging, isn't it? Isn't that jumping into that, whatever internal dialogue is going on inside your brain?
Yeah.
The audience member, at least this is what happened to me. The very first time I saw you, I looked over at you a bunch of times, but I didn't engage. I just was wondering why all these people were starting to gather around you and start laughing. But I'd look at you, and I wouldn't see anything really happening, you know, that I spent. I mean, I didn't look at you for very long. I would look back at the show I was looking at.
Yeah. Well, what happens is that...
But eventually I did go, what the hell is going on over here?
A good mime, in my opinion, you immerse yourself because they seduce you, and then all of a sudden...
But it wasn't physical movement, and you weren't moving on the stilts.
It was.
I didn't see you moving around. You were
in its eye movement, and it's eye movement, and it's sudden little things. Like, I just do little things.
Yeah.
And they denote my attitude towards certain people or what I think those people, you know, like, there's a little cocaine thing that I used to do, and it was so small. And it was just basically really surreptitiously putting it between my index finger and my thumb and sniffing and then becoming hyper. And I'd look at people and I'd do that. And the people that were with me everything I do. You know, that's just one tiny little example. But with Gustav, I would get what he did. And I presumed I wasn't unique in that. And the audience would as well. So he would look at us with disdain and contempt. And then he'd pull this paintbrush out, and he'd just look at us, and he was just saying, I am an artist, and you're not, you know. And someone would walk past with their wife, and he would look at them, because it was opera season, and everyone was dressed up and bejeweled and off to them, and he would look at them, and this is where later in life I got this cemented, that a huge, significant portion of the performance happens inside the heads of the audience, and it's just triggered by the performer. And he would look at this guy with his overweight wife all dressed up, and he would look, and what you saw or what you
thought
you was being communicated was, you poor bastard, it's your wife this week and not your mistress, you know. And then he'd wait for them to pass, and then he would mime the overly large breasts of the woman and mime the walking in high heels. And I'm a very sexually adverse clown. I don't go there. And so I'm screaming, you can't do that. You can't do that. You know, it's misogynistic. I hate all that stuff.
I got you.
And, but then he turns one of the breasts into a bowling ball, and he just goes bowling with it. Like, he transforms it, and he gets out of that little situation. He would do things that I couldn't do. He flirted with people, like, he'd mime a phone, like, you call me, like, da-da-da-da.
Right.
I was brought up Catholic, and I'm also an incredibly repressed individual. So I just can't go there.
Yeah, I'm
I'll dive off a 10-foot diving board, but I won't talk to a woman.
So... I'm saying it. Lurk was born in Paris.
Yeah.
And you couldn't, I mean, there's so many opportunities.
Out of necessity as well, because I'll let you know.
Well, Pompidou's no easy place to work to begin with.
I got arrested there, but that's another story. I would work the Pompidou during the day to pay my rent money, and then I'd work at the Latin Quarter at night for my drinking money. And... because that's what life consisted of.
I see.
That and philosophy.
Okay.
And I still had my 3.5 minute dance piece, which I'd had now for 6 years. I went to Paris. I didn't see Gustav the first time. I went to Paris. I went to Holland. I went to Spain.
When you say Holland, you mean Amsterdam. Or different towns in Holland?
No, different towns as well. Utrecht. But then I went to Spain, and then I had a glorious 6 months.
Spain in Barcelona?
In Ibiza. It's the island. And then I came back towards the end of the season and stayed in Paris, and that's where I met Gustav. And I'm doing my 3.5 minute dance piece. I admit it could be annoying if you live next to it. It's the same, any repetitive music.
Right. Okay.
And so what happened, and I had a remote controlled PA. I'd push a button, it would start playing. A woman on the sixth floor of this apartment building underneath the corner that I was using to perform threw a huge bucket of water down on me after like 2 hours of repetitive Mozart and Iggy Pop.
Okay.
And it didn't drench me, but it landed on my PA system, rendering it useless. And so all of a sudden, my Achilles was very visible to me. I'm like, you don't have a PA anymore. You don't have a dance thing anymore. What are you going to do? And the answer was, get nasty. And so it was also get out of Paris because you don't have the language chops to live here and winter is approaching.
But you're a mime, so why would that... Oh, you mean off stage?
Yeah, well, I didn't talk to girls and I couldn't speak the language. So, you know, just like I wasn't going to get adopted by anybody. So I went to London for the very first time, which I prided myself on because I had spent 6 years.
Now you're legitimately a busker, though.
Well,
I mean,
yeah,
you've done it.
I'd spent 4 years outside of English-speaking countries as a performer.
Yeah.
After leaving New Zealand and before I got to London. So I'm like...
And that's the busking capital of the world.
Yeah.
So did you just immediately run down to Covent Garden?
I went down to Covent Garden. I made in. I did my audition and they sort of nodded and passed me. But I knew it doesn't...
There were different spots there you could work.
It didn't work for me because I needed to be hidden. I needed a corner, and so I used to work the corner
church.
Of the Opera House across from the Shakespeare Pub, I think.
Oh.
I also had a place in Covent Garden, in Carnaby Street.
Right.
And that's where I actually, that's where Lurk first did his thing. And I would get really big crowds and feel idiosyncratic and special because I was doing it not in Covent Garden, where I could only be a peripheral poor cousin anyway. But I was doing it on my own terms and pulling really big crowds and good money. And the policeman there liked me. And a very important agent came and put his card in my hat. And I went and talked to him. And, you know, I got some things started to move really.
This isn't back when you got the spot on Far, Far Away, is it?
Yeah.
It is.
I had that agent in my pocket, and then I was in London for all that winter, and then when the summer came, I had some job by the agent. I had a TV job. See, I get jobs because I was so high profile on Carnaby Street that I was written into a television program.
Really?
That was set in a burger thing, and I was performing outside the burger thing. And that got me some money, and I'm like, okay, I'm out of here. And I went to Ireland. And when I was in Ireland, that's when a writer on the Tom Cruise movie came up and said, I'd like to ask you about your availability. And I said, are you propositioning me? And he laughed and said, yes, in a manner of speaking, I am. And I was able to take my powerful agent's business card out and say, talk to my agent.
Smooth.
Which was, you know, this guy goes, this guy was the agent of whoever won the Perrier Prize at Edinburgh on any given year.
Yeah.
He was the agent to go to. And he picked me, so I was very happy about that.
Well, tell us a little bit about this movie. Or actually, keep going about what did you do after London? I mean, was it just Ireland and then... No, did you ever go back to New Zealand, Australia? You hadn't been back in 4 years.
No, I did Ireland for... It was the year that Dublin was the European cultural capital, which was the reason I went there. I had this idea that I could follow the European cultural capital of the year because I was such a cultural guy. And I worked on the street and I worked on a Tom Cruise movie in parallel. And then I went back to London to pick up my money, basically. And then I met a woman with a dried fowl in a glass box in a bedroom. And then went with her to Perth, Adelaide, Melbourne, and then the Christchurch Festival. I did the summer thing.
And we met in Christchurch?
We might have met that year. Her name was Alison. She had bright red hair and a child. Probably don't remember.
I don't. I remember.
And then from there, Luke was already established. And what I did for the next 6 years was bounce between the Southern Hemisphere and the Northern Hemisphere, working and then doing occasional work in Singapore and Japan. And my first gig in America, which was a private party for somebody who... I can't tell you because I signed a disclosure thing, non-disclosure thing, but James Brown and Aretha Franklin and a 300-strong choir were part of the entertainment package, and it was at the Alagon Ballroom in Detroit. No, Chicago. So that was my first...
So you gig. Did you... have any contact at all with the Halifax people? I mean, obviously Halifax had been going on since 88. And
people had been doing the whole Canadian circuit.
But you didn't have anything to do with that?
You know, I had nothing to do with it. I knew that it existed. And
you would have been
quite
perfect.
Stupidly, I thought I would wait and I would go there when I was invited, and it would be like a good retirement year thing because I'd go and make lots of money. And what actually happened was I did Halifax because they had heard of me. And so they invited me to go to Halifax, and I did Halifax, and I had a terrible time at Halifax because I was persecuted by a shopkeeper in the place that they had allocated me to be.
Right.
And I had a running battle with him and the security guard Dobermans that he had on leash sort of thing. Cool.
That was historic properties. Now, they made all the performers. The early years of Halifax, in my memory, were scattered throughout the town. We actually did shows different places.
No, this was all down in the same place.
Yeah.
So I didn't work that well, I thought. I mean, I kept my integrity, and I did go down there, and I did try to liaise with him, because I am a fairly good political animal. But he was just a black and white guy, and he wanted no compromise at all. And he'd pretend to compromise and then go back on those compromises. He was just aggressive, and he did my head in. So I did really well. I mean, there was no traffic there, but the good thing about my character is it doesn't like its audience, plus it doesn't need its audience. And that's a really attractive thing.
Do you want to say that again?
Well, my character ostensibly doesn't need his audience. He's self-sufficient. Like, that. There's something that I call the approaching violinist syndrome, where you're at a restaurant, you're sitting down having a nice meal,
right?
And suddenly these people walk in, or a person walks in and starts playing the violin and, like, doing table to table.
Yeah.
And the sudden violin, the approaching violinist syndrome is, please don't come here.
Right.
Please. Because they need you. They need your attention.
Right.
And some performers lean heavily on that as well. They're like, their need for their audience is too evident. And it actually scares the audience away.
For sure.
Because the audience aren't prepared to invest in something that hasn't been proven or on the surface of it, doesn't show enough confidence
Isn't that a normal reaction for anything like that? I mean, why should I be looking at you? I'm on my way to do something else. Why do I want to take time out of my day to go over to you? So it's up to the performer, don't you think, to make themselves some sort of maybe visually attractive or to capture their imagination. And that's what I saw with Lurk. That's what I attempted to do with myself. Well, whether the ballyhoo was silent or vocal, I wouldn't see.
You've got to mask your selfishness. You've got to mask your need for their attention.
Your need,
which is not absolutely there, but you can't manifest it.
Right.
You're dying. Right. You've only got two or three people. No one else is stopping inside. You're howling.
Well, just a few seats left. That's what I would say.
Well,
you know, like
inside, you're howling at the moon because it's all failing, but you can't show them.
Absolutely.
There's a couple of techniques that I learned very early on. One was the curious ape syndrome, which is that if a primate sees something that they haven't seen before and it doesn't have a cohesive, easily digestible purpose, they become arrested and almost hypnotized until they can work out a context to put this bizarre behavior
into. I'll 100% agree with you. I never gave it a name like that, but I watched Master Lee work down in Surfer's Paradise, and the first time I ever saw, you know, I mean, I knew him from Washington Square Park, but he was a loud, obnoxious guy.
Right.
And all of a sudden he's down there, and he's getting bigger crowds than the rest of us, because he's silent and he says nothing. He's just setting these boards up and then spraying them with lighter fluid, right?
Right.
And that's exactly what you're talking about here. What do you call it again?
It's the curious ape syndrome.
Curious ape syndromes. Because they would sit around and they would stare at him.
Because what happened was, when we evolved and came off the trees, this is so old, these tricks that we use are just... hacks.
Yes.
When we first came out of the trees, we weren't very good, and anything that was outside our context, the likelihood that it would kill you was pretty damn high.
Yeah.
And so you had to study stuff. You had to be quiet and study things to put them in a context to find out whether they were life-threatening or not. And we still have residues of that in our lizard brain that a performer that knows what they're doing on the street can trigger. It's, you know, you learn all these little things that actually make you perceive reality in a very subtextual way. The fact that I don't need an audience is a conceit, but it's one that I pull off really well. And the fact is that I could sit in a place that had very low traffic and amuse myself. My whole show is about amusing myself. And so...
Wow, you hit the nail on the head.
That is right why there. People are drawn to me, because
absolutely.
I don't need them.
Absolutely. I mean, not to take this in any place, but that's the first thing that I saw. When I say internal dialogue, I'm basically, this guy's up here, they're entertaining himself. He's got this thing going in his head that I joined together. I mean, yeah, there were moments when you would pop out and other people would be involved, but what actually appealed to me the most about what you were doing, when you had nobody else to, somebody wasn't, you had a crowd, but no one was going to walk by that particular corner, or you were looking around the corner waiting for somebody to come, there was nobody there. And what you would do, you would take that mirror and you'd put it in front of your own face. And you just start amusing yourself.
Yeah.
And it was to me, I was like, it seemed to me, and maybe I was writing all these things in my head while you were saying, but I heard you talking to yourself. I heard this inner dialogue that you were doing. And you weren't pleased with everything you saw, and some things you were pleased with. And it just seemed to me that, you know, you were magnifying the human condition up there in some fashion, how we have this inner dialogue going on all the time. Did we do this? Didn't we do this? Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, it seemed so human to me. And then you would punctuate it.
By reaching out.
By reaching out. And then you could start something fresh and new.
I found, because there was no alternative in life, and I'm talking very broadly here, I found that the best I could do was stimulate myself with my own boredom. And that's what I would do. I could be bored in any number of ways. I had all these different rituals to quantify my boredom. And each one of them titillated me a little bit. And in doing that, I was self-contained. And in being self-contained, I drew the attention of others. And in drawing the attention of others, I became an author of the shared experience. And by being the author of the shared experience, I made a living.
And we're going to end it there because, that's ladies and gentlemen, that's Martin Ewan, and that's the way I like him. And I'm sure you'll like him, too, if you ever get to see Lurk. And don't forget to go buy his book. It's Panto Damascus. It's on Amazon and Lulu. You can download a version of
just
it.
Just go to martinewan.com.
Martinewan.com. That's where you want to go. It matters not the job you've got as long as you do it well. Things that are made by plans well laid, the test of time will tell. You cannot count or know the amount, nor the value of a man, by the show displayed or the beauty made, by the touch of the juggler's hand. I am the Butterfly Man, and I thank you for your kind attention.